This is Radio Times in Review. I'm Marty Moscoen. Thanks for joining us. The 2012 presidential election was far and away the most expensive campaign in history, and the 2016 election is expected to have an even bigger price tag. This trend has long disturbed Harvard Law professor Lawrence Lessig. He formed the Mayday PAC in 2014 to provide average citizens with the same political buying power as the major funders. Well, the experiment didn't pan out, so this time Lessig is taking a different approach, running for president and vowing to resign once he passes substantial campaign finance and election reform. Let's listen to my interview with Lessig from last year, in which he discussed why he's so disenchanted with the influence of money on politics. So what's your takeaway from your Mayday PAC and the effect it had on the election last year?
Well, I think the biggest lesson we learned is just how hard it is to get people to separate their partisan obsession from something they also believe, which is the deep corruption of the system, and to get them to act to change the corruption of the system. We found 96% of Americans think it's important to reduce the influence of money in politics, but 91% don't think it's possible. So it's really challenging to give people a sense that it is possible and to give them the motivation they need to do something to bring that about.
Do you need more money? Would that help?
I'm not sure it's about money. I actually think it's about people understanding that this is something different from ordinary politics. You know, one of the problems we had is we, you know, stepped in and we tried to help ordinary candidates running in their races with the traditional tools of politics, you know, advertisements on television. And it was hard for people to see that that was anything different from the same old way the system works. And so hard to get people really excited about the possibility that this could be something different. And I think what that means is we need to think more aggressively about how to do it differently, like how to approach people in a way that doesn't feel just partisan, doesn't feel like you're, you know, really a tool for the Democratic Party or something like that, and really unites people regardless of their political view. Because our belief, really fundamental belief, is regardless of whether you're a Republican or a Democrat, a conservative or a liberal, this corrupt system of funding campaigns makes it impossible for you to get anything you want from our government. We've just, you know, come to the place that the government doesn't function anymore, and we have to step back and say, okay, what do we need to do to fix it so that we can actually have a government that responds to whomever, you know, wins the election.
Is part of the problem is that this is legal corruption, to use your word, legal corruption?
Yeah, that is the most important part. You know, people love to talk about this as if it's about a bunch of criminals or a bunch of really evil people in Congress. But it's not. You know, members of Congress go to Congress for the best possible reasons. But they live within a system that forces them to behave in ways that separates them from the people, separates them because they don't spend time worrying about what the people care about. They spend time worrying about what the funders of their campaigns worry about. It's all perfectly legal. It's all perfectly constitutional. But it's all perfectly corrupt because the framers of our Constitution wanted a government where the Congress would be, quote, dependent on the people alone. And by the people, Madison said he meant, quote, not the rich more than the poor. Well, we've evolved a system where the members of Congress are obsessively focused on what the rich care about, because it's only the rich, only the very, very rich, who are funding the campaigns. And so they spend 30 to 70% of their time talking to these tiny, tiny fraction of the 1% so that they can fund their campaigns and then pretend to turn around and represent the rest of us when they actually vote.
You gave a TED Talk, and I think you said this was maybe a year or two ago, but something like 132 people spent or were donors and came up with something like 60% of the money for, I think it was a presidential campaign.
For the super PACs.
For the super PACs, exactly.
It's only gotten worse. You know, in the last election cycle, about 1.75%, less than 2% of Americans gave anything to anybody. But of that less than 2%, 0.2% gave 66% of the total amount that was spent. The top 100 gave as much as the bottom 4.75 million. And that top 100 gave 70% of the super PAC money that was spent in that election cycle. So we've created the system where this tiny, tiny fraction of America is funding our campaigns. And it's no surprise that we therefore have a government that's incredibly eager to respond to the needs of that tiny, tiny fraction of the 1% by producing policies that benefit them without much concern about how it affects the rest of us.
As you said, most people are unhappy or even disturbed about the influence of money in politics. But, Lawrence Lessig, we don't see people taking to the streets on this. And I don't know if that's the only way that people can represent their frustration with the system. But it is interesting that this is not something that people feel is almost like a civil right.
That's right. And the question is why. Now, the politicos in Washington say the reason is because people don't really care about the issue. But actually, I don't think it's that people don't care. I think it's people don't think there's anything they can do. Again, that poll that we found, 96% thought it was important to reduce the influence of money in politics, but only 91% thought it was possible. That's the politics of resignation. You know, at least 96% of us wish we could fly like Superman, but because at least 91% of us don't believe we can, we don't leap off of tall buildings regularly, right? And that's the same thing here. If you can give people a sense that there is, in fact, something that can be done, if you can give them a path, a credible path that they believe would actually change the system, I think you'd see an enormous amount of energy responding to this, because you've opened up the possibility of something people actually desperately, strongly want to do something about.
But do you think the fact that people maybe feel the system is rigged and perhaps rigged against them just makes them throw up their hands and say, I'm just a little guy. I have maybe $100 I want to give to someone. How am I going to go up against the Koch brothers, for instance, or some of these other big donors?
Yeah, I think that's exactly their reaction. And that explains why a huge percentage of Americans just don't even participate anymore in the political system. And I understand why. It's completely rational. Why should they? There's an amazing study done by Princeton professor Martin Gillens and Ben Page, published last fall, where it's the largest empirical study of policy decisions, actual policy decisions by our government in the history of political science. And what they did is they related those policy decisions to the attitudes of the elite, the economic elite, organized interests, and then the average voter. And they tried to see whose desires actually explained what our government actually did. And what they found was, as the economic elite supported a policy more, it was more likely that policy would be passed. And as organized interests supported a policy more, it was more likely that policy would be passed. But when the average voter supported a policy, it did not affect the probability of that policy being passed at all. It didn't change the probability of it passing at all. Even as we went from 0% of average voters supporting it to 100%, that didn't change the probability of it being adopted. Meaning, in this graph, it's a flat line relating America's democracy to what American voters care about. Now, in a democracy, the idea that the average voter's attitudes can't be shown to affect the actual decisions of the government at all, that's a pretty good signal that the democracy is no longer a democracy. And it's a pretty good reason for most Americans to say, look, I've got two jobs, or I've got kids, or I've got a hobby. I'm going to spend my time focused on that, because there's no reason to spend time focused on what politics is, because politics is just basically responding to what the economic elites or organized business interests want.
I've talked to a number of elected officials over the years, and they all complain bitterly about the fact that they have to spend so much time, frankly, begging for money. And yet, here we are with the status quo. And people complain they don't like it, and yet here we seem to be stuck with it.
Yeah, we do. And you've got to think about the way the system doesn't actually breeds out leadership, right? You've got these people spending 30 to 70% of their time sucking up to the most powerful people in our country. Begging them, really begging them on the phone to give them money. Now, how can you do that 30 to 70% of your day and turn around and try to be a leader on any issue? That's not a leader. That's like learning to be the most obedient follower of the interest of the people who you're trying to beg money from. And we got to change that. We got to give members of Congress the chance to be leaders again by giving them a chance to actually lead, to do their job as congressmen rather than being these kind of low-paid, relative to what other telemarketers are paid, telemarketers, because that's not their job. That's not why we have a Congress.
But money is no guarantee of winning elections. I mean, talk to Eric Cantor, who got beat by a guy few people had heard of, a guy named Dave Brat in Virginia.
That's exactly right. It's not a guarantee, but you got to distinguish between what the money does and what people do to get the money. And what I'm focused on is what they do to get the money. So the reason Dave Brat beat Eric Cantor was that Dave Brat could go around his district and say, that guy is a crony capitalist. He spends all his time sucking up to Wall Street, trying to get Wall Street to give him money. And he does all sorts of favors to Wall Street. And he's not here in Virginia. He's spending all his time in New York trying to get the money from Wall Street, and that's why you should kick him out. And that message among conservative Republicans resonated powerfully. And so the point isn't that Eric Cantor had the money. The point is he had the time and spent his time raising the money from people who were not the people in Virginia who he was supposed to be representing. And he got punished for it. And I think that message is going to go viral in this next election cycle, because there's been more conservative organizations. There's a new one called Take Back Our Republic, who run by the guy who ran David Brat's campaign, who have decided to take this issue and take it nationally to force people to focus on who they should be focused on, their constituents, not the people who are funding campaigns in these large chunks.
They say everything can be replaced.
That was my interview with Harvard Law professor, campaign finance reform advocate, and referendum candidate for president, Lawrence Lessig. You're listening to Radio Times in Review. When we get back from the break, we'll hear about the life and mind of singer Nina Simone. Stay with us.
Of every man who put me here. They say every man must fall. So I swear I see my reflection.
Welcome back to Radio Times in Review. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Netflix just released a documentary chronicling the life and mind of one of jazz's most distinctive voices, Nina Simone, titled What Happened, Miss Simone. We got clued into the unique life of this husky voice crooner when we were joined by her biographer, Nadine Cahotas. We discussed Simone's early life, her struggles with fame, and the complications that arose from her involvement in the civil rights movement. Before we get to that conversation, let's listen to her rendition of Screamin' Jay Hawkins' I Put a Spell on You from 1965.
I put a spell on you. Cause you're mine. Better stop the things you do. I ain't lying. No, I ain't lying. You know know I can't stand it. You're running around. You know better, Daddy. I can't stand it 'cause you put me down. Yeah, yeah. I put a spell on you. Because you're mine. You're mine.
My guest, Nadine Cahotas, has written a biography of the self-described diva called Princess Noir, The Tumultuous Reign of Nina Simone, and she joins us from the NPR studios in Washington, D.C. And Nadine Cahotas, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you so much, Marty. Glad to be here.
Nice to have you here. And listening to her sing, I Put a Spell on You, what do you hear in her voice?
Oh, a sense of mystery. And I think you can pick up when she says, because you're mine, there's just that hint of anger, that hint of defiance, and certainly intensity. The other thing that's so interesting, this was clearly a studio recording, and yet with all the strings, the swooning violins, we can hear Nina cuts right through it to get her message across.
She was one of eight children. She was born Eunice Kathleen Wayman. Tell us a bit about her family, where she came from.
Yes, as you noted, she was one of eight children, almost in the middle, and a very proud family. Her father was so creative in so many endeavors. I loved learning about him, how he could fix cars. He had a dry cleaning business, and he took out a little ad in the Tryon Daily Bulletin that I use as the first chapter's title, Called For and Delivered, because right. To me it had that notion of religion, because her mother became an ordained Methodist minister, and in fact the rest of the little world in Tryon got to see Eunice's talent accompanying her mother at churches. The other point, and I'll try to make this quickly, you know, having talked about the book on Dinah, she was from Tuscaloosa, Alabama, and anybody who knows about the civil rights movement knows that Alabama and Mississippi in particular were harsh places where many important battles were fought. Tryon, North Carolina, is near Asheville, very different kind of place, a much more moderate place because it attracted so many northern art types. And I think that inured to Eunice's benefit. It was two white women who recognized her talent and wanted to make sure it was nourished and nurtured. I don't know that would have happened in the Mississippi Delta in 1933, 1940, 1945, as Eunice was 8, 9, 10 years old.
We're talking about a piano teacher that she had and a white patron, a woman who was a patron, really.
Yes, that's correct. And when I made three trips to Tryon, and one thing I wanted to do, and it was so illustrative, even though things had changed, we figured out where the Waymans' last house was before they moved to Philadelphia. And as you know, Nina has deep ties to Philadelphia.
Yes, indeed.
Parked the car with a friend who was helping me out, and we took the walk that 8-year-old Eunice would have done, literally across the tracks from where her family lived, in sort of the black section of town, but Tryon was really kind of a checkerboard, but literally across the tracks and then up to the hill to the poshiest part of the town, trying to imagine what was that like, and what did she see, and then when she got to the other side, and in a completely different world, and then being schooled by her teacher, Miss Mazzy, Muriel Mazanovich, into the world of Bach and Liszt and Chopin, and then at the end of the day to go back over and go accompany the church choir at St. Luke CME.
Well, you describe several incidents, each of them fascinating. One is that she did attend a segregated school, not surprising at this time and place, but that the principal actually paid someone to burn the school down.
Yes. Isn't that just the most telling, most telling vignette, if you want to get a feel for how separate was not really equal? And I was very lucky that the Tryon Daily Bulletin and even the larger Asheville paper paid attention to this, and it I really can't say anything more about the vignette, except it speaks for itself, that on the surface there is a benign atmosphere. This was not major Klan country. There weren't moments of harassment all the time in the obvious sense, but yet clearly when you went to the movies as a black family, first you could only go to special showings, then they let everybody come in, but you had to sit in the balcony, and it again is a vivid example of what segregation meant.
She was clearly a prodigy, a very gifted young musician. There also was a concert that she was asked to give, and her parents were actually kicked out of the concert, and she fought back.
Right. Kicked out of the front row.
But right, nonetheless, these were her parents. Yes.
That is right. And as Eunice tells it, and I have to say, I tried very hard to verify everything that I could from Nina's autobiography, and I was unable. I did find vignettes in the paper about Eunice Wayman and sometimes singing with her sisters as the Wayman sisters here and there. I could not pin down exactly when that was, but we don't doubt her. But she walked out on stage and just said, if you want me to play, my mother and father are going to have to sit right back down here where I can see them. And as far as we know, that happened. Mm-hmm. And one, at least where Nina put it in her autobiography, it was just an interesting coincidence. Her father was the founding treasurer of the Polk County NAACP. We don't know that the two things were tied together, but there it is.
Well, you mentioned Philadelphia, and she did apply to the Curtis Institute here in Philadelphia with dreams, aspirations of being a classical pianist.
Yes, that's right. And in fact, she had gotten a summer scholarship to Juilliard in 1950, and it was the six-week study at Juilliard that was in preparation for the auditions at the Curtis Institute. And it was a major, major blow when Eunice was rejected. And, you know, we'll never know why. The folks at Curtis were so helpful to me in trying to understand the audition process. And as I'm sure people in Philadelphia know, Curtis is so prestigious because it is small. And there are openings only in your discipline to keep the enrollment at a certain level. Eunice did end up studying with Vladimir Sokolov privately, hoping that she might be able to take the entrance exam, but it was through that accompanying job, the Arlene Smith Studio, that she ended up going to Atlantic City to make money, and that is the moment that we have the birth of Nina Simone.
As you said, she didn't want her parents, perhaps even her mother, finding out that she was singing in bars, and I guess where this all started was Atlantic City.
Yes, the Midtown, the Midtown Bar and Grill, and it was through one of the students that she was accompanying, who was also singing at the Arlene Smith studio, who said he was earning $90 a week in Atlantic City, which was a little better than Eunice was doing. So she got in touch with the person who had booked the student and went to the Midtown, and a man named Harry Stewart hired her. Mm-hmm. And one of my little eureka moments was going to Atlantic City, pulling the newspapers, and I reproduce one of them in the book. There is the ad in Nina's second season, you know, starring at the piano, Nina Simone. You know, not that I didn't think it wasn't true, but it was wonderful to see it.
So does that mean that she had early on success?
I think that's right. No one had ever really heard this amalgam of classical music sitting in a bar, and then hearing this interesting husky, dusky voice over the piano work. And as she said herself, and you got a sense of it just in Little Girl Blue, the way she could mix and match. I mean, these weren't just 2-3 minute little tunes. So she caught on immediately, as you suggested, and one way to tell that was to see how the adjectives in the ads for the Midtown got a little more superlative.
Did she ever have any professional training as a singer?
Not that I know of. Everything was what she had learned as a child singing in choirs, and then, as she tells it herself, while she was accompanying the students at the Smith Studio, she would tell them, as she said, I would try to tell them what I thought they should do, that you have to have feeling, and if they didn't get it, then I would demonstrate myself. And, you know, they actually got it, and I could see I was actually enjoying this. I mean, these are Nina's own words.
But, you know, it's interesting, I always resist this idea of sort of trying to categorize people, and she clearly resisted that and seemed to have sort of an omnivorous love of certain kinds of songs.
That's right, and it also evolved after 1963, which is when Nina embraces the civil rights movement, and not only her music but her look changes. But just to talk about the music first, you start out as a traditional jazz musician with a piano, a bass, a guitar, and the drums. And by the time you get to the late 60s and the 70s and later, there are African instruments, there are Middle Eastern influences, and an eclectic interest to be sure, and a shift in what you want the message to be, I think, both in the lyrics and the sound.
Well, I do want to get to that, but let me play another song performed by Nina Simone. This is the song is titled I Loves You, Porgy, but she changes it slightly as she sings it. This is from, again, the late 50s, words and music by George Gershwin, DuBose Hayward, and Ira Gershwin, and, of course, from the 1935 opera Porgy and Bess. Let's listen to Nina Simone singing I Love You, Porgy.
I love you, Porgy. Don't let him take me. Don't let him handle me and drive me mad. If you can keep me, I want to stay here with you forever. And I'll be so glad. Someday I know he's coming back to call on me. He's going to handle me and hold me so. It's gonna be like dying, Porgy, Daddy, deep inside me. But when he comes, I know I'll have to go.
Again, Nina Simone, a George Gershwin and Ira Gershwin song. I'm intrigued that she just slightly changed how she sang it. It's not I Loves You, Porgy, but I Love You, Porgy.
Yes, she did clean that up, and I believe that she took it from Billie Holiday. That was her introduction to Porgy. She talks about one of the friends she made while she was playing the Midtown, bringing over Billie Holiday's record, and that is where she started to perform it. You know, Nina was later, she had an evolving relationship with how she would sometimes be compared to Billie Holiday, but this is one moment where her interest in what Billie Holiday was doing served her very, very well.
In fact, she said, compare me to Maria Callas, not Billie Holiday.
That is correct. That is correct. I'm not jazz. I feel more in tune with opera.
But does that also tell us about how she thought about herself as a singer, performer?
I think so. You used one of the words earlier, diva, and yeah. I think that there were moments when Nina wanted deeply to be respected, and actually I used that word for one of the chapter titles as well. It was not just in terms of what kind of recording contract she should have, but also she insisted on decorum in clubs, and there's more than one incident where she simply left a booking. She just said, you know, if you're going to talk, I'm not going to play.
Well,
period.
Indeed, and some of them are almost jaw-dropping in what she both says to the audience and what she does.
Yes, that is correct. And later on in her career, and we're in the 70s, some of those moments are actually painful, and you can imagine what it must have been like to be there. And there is a tinge of being out of control. Mm-hmm. And there, I think, is where one has to step back and realize that there were moments when there was illness operating, not just an excessive amount of pride, but a kind of out of control that is not comfortable for anybody, performer or audience.
Do you have a diagnosis, you think, for Nina Simone?
The best I could do was what others said to me, that perhaps a bipolar issue, that by the 80s when she saw medical people and had medication, it helped her be on a more even keel. But it was difficult to be completely specific about this without precise medical records. And then I thought to myself, too, we really care about Nina, don't we, because of the music she left behind and what she represented, in particular at a certain time, this unapologetic rage at the condition of her people, African Americans, in a particular time in the country, and her contribution to helping us understand why one might be angry.
I wish I knew how it would feel to be free. I wish I could break all the chains holding me.
And we close out my conversation with Nadine Cahotas with a song by Nina Simone, I Wish I Knew How It Would Feel to Be Free, from her 1967 album Silk and Soul. When we get back from the break, we'll hear from Cuban-American poet Richard Blanco. Stay with us.
All the love that's in my heart. Remove all the bars that keep us apart. I wish you could know what it means to be me. Then you'd see.
Welcome back to Radio Times in Review. I'm Marty Moss Cohen. Thanks for joining us. One of the highest honors that can be bestowed on a poet is to read at a presidential inauguration. Now imagine, after being the youngest poet to achieve this honor, getting a second call to commemorate an important historical event. This happened to Cuban-American poet Richard Blanco, who was commissioned by the Obama administration to write and recite a poem at the opening of the American Embassy in Havana earlier this month. His poem is called Matters of the Sea. Here's an excerpt.
For the people of both our countries who believed that not even the sea can keep us from one another. Matters of the Sea. Cosas del mar. The sea doesn't matter. What matters is this. We all belong to the sea between us. All of us. Once and still, the same child who marvels over starfish, listens to hollow shells, sculpts dreams into impossible castles. We've all been lovers, holding hands, strolling down either of our shores, our footprints, like a mirage of selves, vanished in waves that don't know their birth or care on which country they break. They break. They bless us and return to the sea, home to all our silent wishes. No one is the other to the other to the sea. Whether on hemmed island or vast continent, remember our grandfathers, their hands dug deep into red or brown earth, planting maple or mango trees that outlive them? Our grandmothers, counting years while dusting photos of their wedding days, those brittle family faces still alive on our dressers.
Blanco joined me in the studio last year to discuss his memoir, The Prince of Los Cucuyos, A Miami Childhood. Let's take a listen.
You know, I'm thinking to be asked to be a poet at a presidential inauguration has to be not just a daunting task, but you have to deliver something for the entire nation, for a president. You have a gigantic audience, I'm sure one you had never imagined. Just what kind of pressure was that for you?
Well, the pressure, of course, was amazing on many fronts. You know, writing a poem is always also an emotional endeavor. So one of the big questions I also came across, which I didn't really sort of realize I was going to stumble upon, is in some ways I'm being asked to write a poem. Well, I'm being asked to write a poem for America, but as I explain in the memoir, that question was still sort of a little vague for me, a little gray. You know, I was like, wait a second, am I American? I mean,
I'm not. You knew the Cuban part, right?
I knew the Cuban part, but I was like, have I arrived? is my story sort of the American story? So that was actually part of the emotional process I had to go through, and that was a big leap in the poem, and that was a big jump start for the poem. The other thing was, again, the audience. So if you think about it, as I've thought about it, that poem was really my first spoken word piece, in the sense that it was the first poem I ever wrote knowing that it would be heard before it would ever be read.
And oh, so, interesting.
So I had 7 minutes to capture the imagination of 40,000, listen to me, 40 million people through the ear before the page. So that was a little sort of groundbreaking for me as well.
Were you nervous?
Yeah. Well, you know, what happened was, you know, a lot of great people stepped in to help me. So from the minute I got the phone call, all I had to do was write, basically, including my partner, including my whole town of Bethel, Maine, where I live. So that helped a lot. But right when I'm waiting to be called up to the podium, or while I'm sitting watching the ceremony go by, something magical happened. And that was, I really got sort of wrapped up in the real meaning of that moment, and realizing that that moment in every 4 years is really much larger than me or my poem or my, you know, my. So the ego sort of took a back seat, and actually my nerves were able to calm down. And so the idea that as I'm sitting there, that same question that I had asked before, am I American? Do I have a right to write this poem and address the whole country? As I'm sitting there with my mom, who grew up in a dirt floor home in Cuba, it suddenly dawned on me, it's like, this is the American story, or a big part of it. And everything that I realized that I represented suddenly became real and true.
But I was wondering whether, and all the thinking that you had to go through to be this inaugural poet, whether that led to your memoir, because it got you thinking about yourself and where you came from. And I'm sure, you know, interviewed by everyone under the sun that wanted to know about your family and right. Blah, 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 all of that.
Well, you know, it's interesting. I mean, the project started a couple years before, obviously, the inauguration. But it's interesting how in the arts, and as I always say, sort of the poems are smarter than I am, or they premeditate, because you're already working on things, and somehow all those questions sort of were already there. And in some ways, I feel as if I have this great script of my life. I mean, let me give you an example. My very first poem assignment in graduate school was, we read some Ginsberg and some Whitman and some Frost, and my very first assignment was write a poem about America. And it became my first poem in my first book. And that arc of questioning my place in America, suddenly being asked to write this poem, sort of was the end of this arc of understanding about my place in America. And of course, now begins a new arc of understanding my place in America. But so in some ways, all, as I always say, every writer sort of is writing the same poem or the same story over and over again. I think another poet said that, but I'll steal it. And this idea that we're circling around the same obsession. And for me, it's that idea of home. So it's even larger than just Cuban or Latino, but really, what is home to us? And what does that mean? What does that loaded word mean in terms of family, in terms of culture, or in terms of sexuality, in terms of all these different species of information?
Well, as you said, you were conceived in Cuba, born in Spain, grew up in Miami. How much was, as a kid growing up, and this clearly was a very tight-knit Cuban community, how much was Cuba this this almost like a TV show. I mean, that was so real to your family, but something that you had no personal connection with except through them.
Well, as I call it, there was a real imagined Cuba and a real imagined America as well. It was especially poignant because my mother left her entire family in Cuba.
This was 68, right?
In 68, right. And she had eight brothers and sisters, and I mean, every single last cousin, uncle, aunt. So I felt like I grew up with half a family, but that other half of family was always present in letters that would come every day, telegrams, all those black and white photos that I would sort through, like trying to see someone that looked like me in my family. It was this mysterious world that seemed so real and yet completely not tangible. And it was this place where we were from. And the sort of feeling, I mean, the feeling started fading a little bit more, but there was also always this feeling in the exile community that don't get too comfortable because any day we might have to pack our bags and go back because we're not... We're here, but we're not here. And it's that you can understand why the question of home and identity was, from the moment I was born, was already in the air, right? So so that was – it was very, very much a big part of the influence. In some ways, even before questions of sexuality, I already had questions of home and identity because I was like, wait a minute. And then they would call me El Galleguito, which means the little Galician.
A little Galician.
And I'm like – But I know Cuban because I was born in Madrid, and
right.
And so in Cuba, anybody from Spain, they call him Gallego, you know. So all these layers, and it was magical. I mean, in a weird way, it was very confusing, and in a weird way, it was in another way, it was very magical because there's always this sense of always on the cusp of discovery of something. Yeah.
Well, I had to laugh when you not just were a fan of the Brady Bunch, but actually thought this is really how the other America, the America that's sort of outside of our community, this is how Americans live.
Yeah, no, certainly. And it was more than just sort of a casual sort of fantasy or anything like that. I mean,
you really thought this is how Americans live.
Yeah, because here's the irony, right? Like, and I think people will get this, but I grew up in a very undiverse community. It's diverse looking from the outside in, but from the inside out, it was all Cuban. So so my classmates from the majority were Cuban-American like me. The grocer was Cuban. The gardener was Cuban. But so was the doctor and the lawyer and the engineer. So it was a whole strata of the community was Cuban. So I grew up with people just sort of like me. And I think Liz Balmaceda, the journalist, said once, we love living in Miami because it's so close to the United States and you don't need a passport, right? and it's still like that. You know, it's still – people are – that's why they love Miami. It really feels like so close and yet so far.
They brought their own country with them, right?
So how I contextualize America was TV shows, food, which we'll probably get to in a minute, commercials, the really sort of G versions of history books, you know, here in – you know, Franklin and all the rest here in Philadelphia, you know. I mean, really, there's this other – felt like this other Cuba, this other sort of country that I was going maybe go to someday and really believed that north of the Miami-Dade County line as a child that every house was a Brady Bunch house and that every neighborhood looked like the neighborhoods on TV and that – Yeah, someday I'd so Miami felt like sort of I call it like a cultural purgatory, and not in a bad sense, but the sense of a waiting ground between the real imagined Cuba or the real imagined United States. It's like, well, which one's heaven and which one's hell? I'm not sure, but one day we'll go in one or the other. You know,
I'm curious as a kid, so listening to your parents or family talking about Cuba, was it a kind of a longing to go back? Was it an anger that they had to leave?
My parents were a little bit different as we came in 68, right? There was sort of a middle class, middle to lower middle class immigration later in the 60s. So I didn't particularly grow up with like a lot of sort of hate and stuff, but certainly hurt. I mean, there's this sense of hurt. Who's to blame or not blame is another question or what. But the idea is my mother didn't have her family. I mean, it just hurt.
And you sensed that. You knew that.
Yeah. You felt that it wasn't even really something that was ever explicit. There was no sort of indoctrinating kind of conversations. But even in the community at whole, and I think that's why I came to poetry as also to try to capture that elusive sort of just this sense of in between the lines feeling of the community at whole, the sense of hurt, the sense of... of being lost a little.
Did you feel protective of your parents? I mean, yes, you were embarrassed by them, as all children, as you say, are embarrassed by their parents, but also protective, sort of knowing, perhaps not knowing a lot, but knowing they clearly left something behind to come to America.
Yeah, I think there was, you know, it was okay for us to make fun of them or to take advantage of them. Yeah, I think it's, you know, it's universal in that sense. It's like, I can make fun of my parents, but don't you make fun of my parents, you know. And so, and especially in cases where there's, where they're met with some little bigotry or a little bit prejudice, and this idea of when they would speak English, when they had to, a very accented English, which was a real challenge to write in the book and something I really had to negotiate in terms of craft in the book. But yeah, we got very protective because, again, it's this duality. It's like, hate being Cuban, but I love being Cuban. Hate being Cuban, but I love being Cuban. And don't we always have that engagement with our country?
Indeed.
And I think that sort of, you know, I love America, I hate America, you know, one day, you know, and it's this constant struggle of identity and place and connection and how all that fits. For me, and I think for first-generation immigrants especially, there's an added layer, which is you're really dealing with two countries again. You're negotiating, you're triangulating a lot more, several more things. Yeah.
But kids have a lot of power under those circumstances, right? You speak the language, you know the culture. As you said, you know, your parents were at your linguistic mercy.
Yeah, yeah. And not just sort of in situations, but even like in school, for example, you know, letters that we'd bring home, like, oh, don't worry about it. We sort of translate. Yeah, it means I'm doing
not
great.
No problem.
I'm doing great.
I am paying attention.
Unless there was
right?
a letter grade or something. My parents never went to teacher parent conferences because, well, if it was a Cuban teacher, they might because, again, another layer was the social working class family. They hardly had time. But certainly I remember, you know, the few Anglo teachers, well, not even Anglo, God only knows, not Cuban teachers
right,
that I had,
right.
They wouldn't go because they were terrified to speak, you know, have to speak the language. They knew how to somewhat, but they were terrified to. So even sort of not just situations, but, you know, things we'd get around to. I mean, papers from, you know, the IRS, I'd have to, like, you know, you're being audited, Mom.
Is that true?
What does that mean? No, no, I'm just, but no, sometimes to this day, still important papers, my mom would be like, what does this mean? Like, you know, and I'm like, don't worry about it. You know,
everything will be fine.
Everything will be fine.
Your parents named you after Richard Nixon?
Yeah.
True? True?
Well, it's, my dad told me that once, and I've never, after he passed, I wasn't able to ever confirm it. And so the White House actually had caught wind of that. I mean, they had told me, you said this, like, right. Be prepared because the press might ask you this question.
Exactly. But do you like the idea of Latino? I mean, sort of how people from all these diverse and different countries then get called one thing in this country.
Yeah, it's an interesting and sort of wonderful problem to sort of have. And I was just thinking about this last night because I've been in conversation with someone about a TV series sort of based on, yeah, just a very casual conversation. I don't want to let anything out of the bag. But one thing I was explaining to them that, okay, yes, you know, it's hard to you can't lump everyone together because as Latino groups, we totally get the subtle differences. But we also enjoy other, you know, there isn't the sense that it's completely foreign either. So we do have sort of some sort of common groundwork, especially when we come to the United States, where we kind of face some similar linguistic challenges. If you're the middle generation, that kind of issue, you know, of that sort of has some common ground. But yeah, I mean, it's there's a joke I think in our communities that you say, you know, if you have a room full of Latinos and just Latinos. I'm Colombian. I'm Puerto Rican. And I'm this or I'm that. Or I'm you know, I'm Venezuelan. And then the minute sort of a perceived Anglo or non-Spanish speaking person walks in, we all go, "We're Latino," because in a sense, it's a collective. There is a bond that sort of does sort of connect us.
That was my conversation with inaugural poet Richard Blanco, who was recently commissioned by the U.S. government to write a poem for the opening of the American Embassy in Havana. And that wraps up this edition of Radio Times in Review. You can email us at radiotimes@whyy.org and tell us what you think of the show. Radio Times is produced by Susan Greenbaum, Debbie Builder, Emily Bryant, and John Ahrens, who edits the show. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Thanks for listening and have a great weekend.